This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Special greetings to the feminists out there, male and female, listening to today's show, which we dedicate to International Women's Day, which is March 8th. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood feminist atheist. And hello not only to Madison listeners, but those of you listening in Atlanta, Anchorage, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and the Monterey coast of California. This is the weekend of March 6th and 7th, 2010. Our show, Free Thought Radio, is a weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF, Inc., a national organization of atheists and agnostics, keeping state and church separate, as our Constitution mandates, and educating the public about the views and opinions of those of us who are not religious in America.
On the second half of Free Thought Radio, we'll play an interview we conducted with Ayan Hirsi Ali in person last month. Ayan was in Madison, Wisconsin last month as part of the Distinguished Lecture Series at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which FFRF co-sponsored. And we've been holding on to that very special interview to play in honor of International Women's Day and also because March is Women's History Month.
Ayan Hirsi Ali is the Somalian exile whose book, Infidel, recounts what happened to her when she escaped an arranged marriage in Somalia by becoming a feminist activist for Muslim women refugees in the Netherlands. She was eventually elected to the Dutch parliament in 2003. Ayan, and her first name is spelled A-Y-A-A-N, Ayan penned the script for the film Submission, which criticized the treatment of women in Islamic society, bringing her to international notice. 2 months after the film's release in 2004, the film's producer, Theo van Gogh, who's a great-grandnephew of Vincent van Gogh, was viciously murdered as he bicycled in Amsterdam, murdered by a Moroccan member of a Dutch Islamist terrorist group. The assailant, who was later convicted, pinned a death threat to Ayan Hirsi Ali on Van Gogh's body.
So we'll play an interview with Ayan Hirsi Ali on the second half of Free Thought Radio, and you can hear for yourself what this has meant for her life in her own words.
Since we'll be hearing about the threat to freedom posed by the campaign to impose Sharia, or Muslim law, upon women, we want to continue the theme of the harm of religion to women during this, the first half of our show, because this is Women's History Month. We should note that the history of women to gain civil rights has really been the struggle of women to emancipate themselves from religion.
And I would, of course, argue that all of the major world religions are patriarchal and, in fact, are predicated on the oppression of women, and that the fundamentalists of all these religions pose a great threat to women. The fundamentalists of the world religions, whether Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, or Islam, are more similar than they are different from each other. But in this country, of course, we mainly see theocrats wishing to invoke the Christian Bible in our laws and impose it on our lives.
So, Annie Laurie, we actually didn't need to invite another guest to talk about the Bible and sexism because you would be a good guest. You've written a book about that very topic, about Bible sexism. The book is called Woe to the Women, The Bible Tells Me So. So tell us a little bit about the book, and what is wrong with the Bible's teachings about women?
Well, shall I start at the beginning?
In the beginning?
In the beginning, such as Genesis, where there's this chokehold immediately imposed on women. We have a bumper sticker at the Freedom From Religion Foundation that we have been selling well, briskly, for more than 30 years. It says Eve was framed, and that pretty much says it in a nutshell. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who's the 19th century feminist who was the first to call for women's rights, the vote, wrote a book called The Woman's Bible.
In the United States.
Right? Well, no, she was the first in the world, as far as I know. She wrote a book in the late 1800s called The Woman's Bible, and she loved to point out in that book, and also she did many, many lectures on the Bible and women, that in the first version of creation that you find in Genesis, man and woman are created together. At the same time, they're both given dominion over the earth. And we don't have time in this show to go into what's wrong with that idea about humans having dominion over the planet. We're going to have to say that for another show. But what she points out is that the churches of her era, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and most today still seem to only know about that second version of the creation myth that you find in the Bible, the Adam's rib story. And so what we see is that woman is, by the third chapter of Genesis, women have already lost our identity. And we've been typecast as innately sinful and sin-inciting temptresses by the Bible. Eve's interest in eating that fruit of the tree of knowledge, which actually should have been considered praiseworthy.
Would you have grabbed it?
Sure.
If you had been
there? Who wouldn't? I mean, who wouldn't want knowledge if you could
eat a piece
of fruit? Well, supposedly this led to the downfall and damnation of the entire human race. And so we're only into the third chapter of the Bible before woman has just been completely written off. And then we see this terrible biblical curse in Genesis 3:16. And Dan, since this was undoubtedly a passage written by a man, why don't you read it?
You see at the football games, John 3:16. Well, here's Genesis 3:16. I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee.
Well, I don't need to talk about what's wrong with that. And to make up for reading this noxious Genesis passage, Dan, could you read this very eloquent passage that I found for you by Elizabeth Cady Stanton about what the Bible says about women? It's such a succinct summary.
Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote, "The Bible teaches that woman brought sin and death into the world, that she precipitated the fall of the race, that she was arraigned before the judgment seat of heaven, tried, condemned, and sentenced. Marriage for her was to be a condition of bondage, maternity a period of suffering and anguish, and in silence and subjection, she was to play the role of a dependent on man, bought for all her material wants and for all the information she might desire. Here is the Bible position of woman, briefly summed up."
And so we don't have time to do justice to all the insults to women that are in the Bible, but briefly I can say that the Bible, and we're talking about the Christian Bible, we're talking about the Old and New Testaments, the Hebrew Bible and New Testament, establishes women's inferior status. It officially calls women unclean. This is due to our reproductive capacities. This is a very primitive patriarchal view of menstrual periods. Women in the Bible, when they are mentioned, and that's kind of scantily, and usually if women are mentioned in the Bible, they're nameless, exist as appendages, as in Adam's rib. Biblical women are male possessions. Fathers own them, they can sell them into bondage, they can even sacrifice them. And there is such a sacrifice in the Bible. You always hear about Abraham and his son Isaac, but you don't hear about Jephthah and his nameless daughter. The Bible sanctions rape under most circumstances, and women, of course, are commanded to be in silence. And you'll see this is shared by the Islamic interpretation of the Quran when we get to that interview with Ayan Hirsi Ali, who is sort of the ultimate symbol of the extent to which religion seeks to silence women. And so the Bible commands that women be subservient to their husbands. Women are subject to Mosaic law sanctioned bed checks as brides. And
bed checks.
They looked for the blood that they were virgins, and if they weren't, they were to be taken to the center of town. All of the men were to stone them to death. And we still see this happening in some Islamist-based cultures because they share the Mosaic law in common. There were jealousy fits that were sanctioned by the Bible, which could also kill women. There was no notice divorce. Virgins are booty, the spoils of war. Many biblical women are characterized as, the terrible language, harlots and whores. And their sins and powers of allurement are described as nothing less than satanic. And when nations rebel or displease the biblical Lord, they're referred to as lewd women, really gross and graphic descriptions of their punishment, frequently sadistic and sexual, are ordered.
Well, how about some examples?
Well, for instance, here's the Old Testament divorce rule, which is still followed by some ultra-Orthodox Jewish law in Israel, for example, some Islamist law. It allows a husband to hand a wife a bill of divorcement and kick her out of the house if some uncleanness in her is discerned, and that's out of Deuteronomy.
Does the Old Testament grant fastidious wives the same right?
Well, what do you think?
Well, what about all those folks who think we get family values then from the Bible?
Ruth Hermance Green, who wrote the Foundation-published book, The Born Again Skeptic's Guide to the Bible, it's still selling, she liked to refer to this idea of the Christian family as a Christian fantasy. And if you look at just one area, for example, incest, you'll notice adultery makes the top 10 in the Ten Commandments, but not prohibitions against sexual violence, rape, sexual abuse of children. And that's because while incest is technically forbidden under Mosaic law, biblical stories are replete with unpunished incest with titillating details. You know, Abraham is the father of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. He's esteemed. He married his half-sister, and he even prostitutes her. So that's kind of the Bible's unwholesome attitude toward incest is just one example. And then we get to, moving right along to the New Testament, of course. Dan, why don't you just read one passage from the New Testament that's typical about what it says about women being in silence and subjection.
Let the woman learn in silence with all subjection, but I suffer not a woman to teach nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. For Adam was first formed, then Eve. Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, was in the transgression.
And it just kind of keeps getting worse. Dan, how about reading 1 Corinthians 14, 34-35?
Let your women keep silence in the churches. It's not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it's a shame for women to speak in the church.
And since this is Women's History Month, let me point out that until about 150 years ago, these Bible injunctions were largely the rule of the Western world. You know, women not only couldn't vote, but we had no identity beyond wife and daughter. We couldn't serve on juries, sue or be sued. We couldn't attend colleges or universities. It was civil death. And it was the early women, the unorthodox women, who fought the Bible, fought these injunctions, who got us our rights. And every single attempt to get rights, whether it was riding bicycles or not wearing bonnets in church or being permitted to attend universities and enter professions to vote, obviously, was openly and actively opposed by the churches. The churches were the main enemy of women's rights.
Well, that's the topic of your other book, Women Without Superstition, No Gods, No Master. You profile a lot of these women.
Yes, and just one of them, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, whom I've mentioned before, wrote that in the early days of the women's suffrage movement, the Bible was hurled at us from every side. And we, you know, we've come a long way thanks to the women who fought against church stricture. We still see this going on in the Muslim world today. They are kind of fighting what they're sort of where our country was back in the 1840s. They're fighting against the Quran and their imposition in the law through Sharia. And so we think with International Women's Day and Women's History Month, we should be thanking and celebrating the women free thinkers who were the first to call for so many women's rights, including people like Margaret Sanger, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and that they have taught us why we should not have dogma in law today.
There will be peace on earth when there is goodwill toward women. I'm Dan Barker. I'm talking with Annie Laurie Gaylor about sexism in religion. We'll be back in a few minutes. Stay tuned for our interview with the author of the book Infidel, a woman who has to travel with bodyguards because she has criticized the Islamic religion. Her name is Ayan Hirsi Ali. Stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Ron Getz from Washington, D.C., and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Geller with Dan Barker. We have coming up an interview with Ayaan Hirsi Ali, author of Infidel. Now, the last segment, we were talking about sexism in the Bible and about the New Testament and how it prescribes this master-slave relationship between man and woman. And here's the master of what the Bible means, a little clip from Reverend Pat Robertson talking just about that very thing.
The first head of the family is Jesus Christ. He is our head. We believe in headship. Now, under Jesus is the husband. And the husband is to be the high priest of the family.
Ugh. Well, enough of that. But you see, here's the New Testament. That's exactly what it says. First God, then man, then woman at the bottom.
And then the kids, and then the animals.
So to change the subject, and in honor of International Women's Day and our upcoming guest, and in honor of my mother, Ann Gaylor, the founder of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, we'd like to play her favorite feminist anthem.
And whenever Ann's in the room when I'm sitting at the piano, she always asks me to play her favorite song. It's called Bread and Roses. It's really commemorating a mill worker strike way back in the, 1914? But it's become more of a general feminist anthem. So, Anne, this song is for you and feminist freedom fighters everywhere.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people here are singing bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle two more men. For they are in the struggle, and together we shall win. Our day shall not be sweated, from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient call for bread. Small art and love and beauty their trudging spirits knew. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too. As we go marching, marching, we're standing proud and tall. The rising of the women means the rising of us all. No more the drudge or idler, 10 that toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories. Bread and roses, bread and roses, bread and roses.
Coming up, we were very pleased to get the chance to meet Ayaan Hirsi Ali when she came to Madison last month. She's an atheist. She's the author of the best-selling book, Infidel, chronicles her Somali childhood, her sudden flight to Holland to avoid an arranged marriage, her university education, her work with women, particularly Somali refugees, opening her eyes to the harm of religion to women and what's happened to her since the assassination of the filmmaker who produced her film, Submission.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. Stay tuned for our interview with Ayaan Hirsi Ali. It was a rare occasion, and she's very eloquent.
And charming.
And charming, and has a lot to say, so she'll be on next.
Hi, my name is Shelley Mountjoy from Washington, D.C., and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker. A month ago, we had the pleasure of interviewing Ayaan Hirsi Ali in person in Madison, Wisconsin, and now we're going to listen to that interview.
And we're very happy to have right here in Madison, Wisconsin. We are at the Inn in the Park, right across the street from the Capitol in Madison, Wisconsin, speaking with Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who is here in town. Today is Tuesday, February 2nd, here to give a distinguished lecture speech at the University of Wisconsin. And it's a real pleasure to meet you in person, Ayaan.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to meet you, and thank you for having me.
I read your book when it first came out in 2007, and a fascinating, you know, the first half is fascinating. That world in Somalia where you grew up and being a little girl in those interesting and horrible things that happened to you. But in the middle of the book, it became gripping. It was like one of these thriller tales. It was just a page-turner when your father married you off in 1992, and you were flying to marry your cousin in Canada. Was that where it was? And then you escaped. You jumped off the plane.
I don't tell the whole story, Dan.
Well, and then you ended up in Parliament in Holland, and then and later in the show, we'll talk about what you're doing for women's rights and all of that. But tell us a little more about your story and why you changed.
Well, first, I want to say that when we use the word globalization, it's so abstract and you read it all the time. You don't think twice about it. Most people don't understand it. But what happens is that you don't go from a place, you don't only go from a place like Somalia to Holland, like I did. But once you're there, then you realize, oh my God, everything is different. The way people look, the way people eat, the way people think, the way people interact, everything is different. And this difference, for me, was like moving not just geographically from Nairobi to Dusseldorf, Bonn, and then Holland, various cities. But it was like a journey in time. It was like I moved 1,000 years fast forward, or maybe 100 years. Maybe it would be 1,000 years for my grandmother, but maybe 100 years for me. And I think that's what people don't realize. And when you say your story is gripping and it's like a thriller, it's not like a thriller, and it's not gripping if you're growing up in Somalia. It's boring. Or if you're growing up in Kenya, or if you're growing up in any other non-Western country. But when you come to the West, my experience in the West for me was a thriller. It was gripping because I thought also all these ideas about freedom, enlightenment, secularism, they are not just abstract ideas beyond my understanding only for a few people in the elite. They're for everybody.
Yeah. Well, your escape from that oppression of that culture, that you would have the independence and the courage to just get off that plane and not know what the heck was coming in this strange modern world, to think for yourself and decide you were going to make your own life. I mean, to me, that was what was gripping, that you had that kind of a courage.
Now, here's the surprise. Lots and lots of people have that courage. All immigrants have that courage. Every single man and woman who decide, I'm going to leave where the place I am born. I'm going to leave my family. I'm going to leave my property. I'm going to sell everything I have, and I'm going to take a chance on the unknown and move miles and miles away from where I am. Yeah. All of those people are courageous, and all of these people are brave. And I want to repeat something that Christopher Hitchens tells me all the time. And he says, you know, the fact that you moved from A to B is in itself not so interesting. Millions of people do that. What's interesting is that you moved from A to B and got yourself into, you found for yourself a life in the West, and you're still sane. Oh, he's a very humorous man. But I think that's what we need to think about, which is making a choice between the value system and the moral framework that my parents and my grandparents gave me. And then to come to a place like Holland, see these values, live them, judge them on their merits, and then adopt them and face the consequences of deserting or rejecting the old moral framework. And I think there's so many people on the verge of doing that.
Now, what you had to do, though, was basically escape an arranged Islamic marriage. And when you made that escape, I mean, you were still a practicing Muslim, right?
I was a practicing Muslim. I was scared. I was terrified, not only of being caught and the physical consequences of being punished, you know, beaten, all of that, but I was also scared of what if I, you know, got into a car accident and I died. I would be punished in the grave. The grave would contract. Huh. It would be an endless process of pain until the proper hereafter, where I would be judged and then thrown into hell. So it's not just, people think it's the obstacle of, oh, you know, you're going to be beaten, you're going to be jailed, you're going to be killed, and then when you come to a place where there's the rule of law, you can escape those physical punishments. But if you are mentally programmed to think that there's going to be a time when people will live forever and you'll live in pain and hell, that's a great deterrent.
Yes, reaches into the afterlife. Nothing else but religion, you know, tries to blackmail you like that.
I remember that.
It's a cheap way of blackmailing people.
I was a fundamentalist Christian, and I used to believe that. There are real demons and real flames. And the Bible and the Quran both talk about the flames and the flesh burning and all of those things. Horrible. Yeah. What a thing to tell children.
And for some reason, people in the West do not understand how horrifying and how gripping and how influential those things are. You can make people do things just with the threat of what could happen to them in the hereafter. But there's another punishment closer home here, life on earth. And that is, what will my father think? What Right. will he say? What will he do to me? What will my mother think? My friends? And the first remarks, not after I escaped marriage, but after I left Islam, was not, and I didn't leave Islam. I asked questions, and I was told, you're an infidel, you're a traitor, you're a heretic, you're betraying us, etc. And then you know the rest. And I'm not even talking about the outsiders who are threatening me, intimidating, but just the sheer rejection of those people you love the most. You can't go home, and home is what it used to be, or what it is.
Well, you were hiding from them. You were escaping.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, we have to fast forward to your being an immigrant and fearful for your life to becoming a member of parliament. And how did you become involved with Theo Van Gogh and its submission is the film?
Yeah. So think of the context of the Netherlands. When I came, it was 1992, when Theo and I made the film, it was in 2004. But in that country, even though there's been immigration and there's a presence of a large group of Muslims, relatively large group of Muslims, it's still a really free country. People haven't been exposed to the world outside of the West. And the greatest provocateur they had was Theo van Gogh. Oh. And Theo used to say, I'm the village idiot. And everybody would say, if you want to find a sentence in the Dutch language that will enrage someone, go to Theo, he'll help you with it. He was the provocateur. And I went to him, he voted for me, he came to me, we had all kinds of exchanges. And then I told him about an idea I had for a museum piece, and I was going to use dolls because I didn't want actresses to be killed. And he said, this has to be a film. And that's when he made it. And he told me, all my life was devoted to provoking people. I'm going to do today something that's not about provocation. It's a gift to Muslim women. And it is so unfortunate that he was killed for that.
killed for giving a gift of freedom to people. Yeah.
To Muslim women. To women.
And you had to go into hiding immediately?
I was transported in a military airplane from very secretly deep in the night to a military airport in the United States. I was flown out by 7 or 8 Marines and hidden here in the U.S.
And you didn't know where you were even, right?
Well, I can read this time. I could read street signs. So I understood I was in Andover. And I was somewhere close to Minuteman or Minuteman. Minuteman. So I got that bit because I can read and write. But I was not allowed to have my computer with me or go on the internet, my telephone, be in touch with anyone else for 75 days.
Wow. Well, and we've got to wind up this part of the interview, but you soon immigrated to the United States then.
No, I immigrated in 2006 to the United States, but there was a lot that went on between 2002, 2004, and 2006 when I left Holland for good.
And since that time, you've had to have special security around you.
I have had special security since the 16th of September, 2002.
When Theo was killed?
No.
Before
he was killed in November. He was killed because he had no security. I'm alive because I have security.
I'm Annie Laurie Geller with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. We'll be right back to continue this interview with Ayan Hirsi Ali.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio. Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
And we're back. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Geller for Free Thought Radio. And we are talking in person with the charming and intelligent Ayan Hirsi Ali, author of the book Infidel. And you were telling us your story, how you escaped Islam. Well, you didn't really tell us about your inner beliefs and changes and all that. You eventually acknowledged you were an atheist. And when did that happen?
It was a gradual process. I stumbled on things that didn't make sense to me, even as young as 4 or 5 years old. And, my grandmother was bending over, and I thought, well, grandmother, why are you bending? And then she said, and she hit me because, I played around and disrupted her prayer. And she said, you don't do that when one is talking to God. And I tell you, there was no one in the room, so I kept saying things like, there was no one in the room. And I was made to understand as early as that time, God is invisible, and you don't hear him, but you have to submit to him. And then later we were living in Saudi Arabia, and my father was having this exciting life, and my sister and I and my mother were not allowed to go out of the house. We were kept inside. We didn't seem to share in their world. And I kept saying, my father said, men and women are equal, and according to Islam, and the paradise is under the feet. Allah says paradise is under the feet of women. And I thought, under the feet of mothers. And I looked at his feet, and they were, shod in these expensive Italian shoes, and my mother's feet were worn. And I thought, well, that doesn't have. And then we learned about floggings, amputations, and in Saudi Arabia, you don't only learn about them. My brother actually went to those squares and watched them. Or I don't know if he saw something, but after you pray, you can go.
People who violated the law, Sharia?
Sharia, if you steal, you amputate, your hands are cut off. I don't know even if it's proven. Anyway, but what fascinated me, and I used to ask myself, was if God is so compassionate and so merciful, that is the... Every single chapter except one in the Quran opens with Allah is passionate and merciful. then why the amputations, why the floggings, yeah. why the stonings?
Contradictions.
And then later, as a young woman, thought, why do I have to submit to my husband completely and obey, and as he doesn't yeah. submit and obey me? So there were all these questions and contradictions that were in my mind, but they really, really, I really didn't have the courage to go beyond them until after the 11th of September. And even then, I only depended on my 5 years in the University of Leiden, where I was educated in critical thinking.
And at that point, you realize there's no evidence in, for the existence of a God or for any of these teachings of these holy books.
Yeah, there was the moment when you look at yourself in the mirror and you think, there's no hell, there's no heaven, and you think, God, the sky hasn't fallen on me. I'm still there. I'm not smitten.
No, you write in your book, Infidel, about one of those first times when you went out without a veil and what that was like.
Without a veil.
Mm-hmm.
When you feel like you're naked
yeah.
and that everyone is looking at you, and there'll be car accidents and men will tumble over one another. And
because we can't control ourselves. We see a woman's
yes.
hair, we're going to
yes,
crash
yes.
the car.
You know, the vision of Islam on women is very clear and it's much talked about. Hmm. But the vision of Islam on men is that they're these uncontrollable sexual he-goats. And anytime you do, as a man, you are confronted with even the smallest bit of bare skin, female bare skin, you lose your senses, you go after her and you rape her the way yeah. a he-goat would jump goats that my grandmother had, and, you know, rams would jump yeah. sheep.
Maybe that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It Maybe the men think, this is how I am, and I, you know, my religion tells me, and women are my property, and I better control them. You know?
And I believe that, and I think millions of people believe that and behave in that way until I came to the Netherlands and realized nobody, when I took off my headscarf and short sleeves, and no one looked at me, and it was in the summer, and no male seemed to be interested in what females were doing. And I told my Somali friends, but look, why do we have to cover themselves? They are not. Everything seems to be peaceful and nice. And they said, oh, but you know, white men are not real men.
Now, we want to talk about this foundation you just started. You know, you're very intelligent and very courageous, and you have this fierce drive for independence in life. Why are there not more women like you? And isn't your foundation trying to do something about that?
There are more women. Not just like me, but braver, more intelligent, who want to get out of that prison, mental prison and physical prison. But look at the two young women who grew up in Texas, Sahra and Amina. One was 17, one was 16, the other was 18, when their father killed them. They dated American boys, they had straight A's in school, they were beautiful, just the most promising youth you can think of. And those young girls, they protested and were protesting for many years and were living their lives. And their father warned them and beat them and closed and confined them, and they wouldn't break down. And then he decided there's only one way to break down, and that's to kill them.
Well, there certainly are headlines about that very frequently in this country and around the world.
It is emerging, but I hope that there were as many headlines about young women in America who face the plight of Sahra and Amina than, you know, Natalie Holloway. Every young, white, agnostic or Christian woman in the United States or in the Western world who in any way faces some kind of abuse, that is national headlines for a long time.
But that would be nice, wouldn't it?
But in the name of, which is good, in the name of culture and religion, especially the Islamic religion, the perpetrators of honor killings, forced marriages, all kinds of unfriendliness and hostile treatment of women is excused. It's excused because now it's done
in the name of religion.
Religion and by a man of color.
And we mustn't criticize it. It would be cultural imperialism.
Yeah.
And yet, so women's rights are not truly civil rights if that were true.
Well, then it becomes so universal human rights
mm-hmm,
and universal
exactly.
women rights become reduced to white women's
right.
rights.
Now, we want to briefly mention, what is the name of your new foundation?
It's the AHA Foundation, which is an abbreviation of my name, Ayan Hirsi Ali, but it's the AHA Foundation. And our mission statement is to protect the rights of women from militant Islam and tribal custom in the United States.
In the United States.
Yeah, we believe in charity begins at home.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
If you get it right here, you'll get it right in Afghanistan.
Very true.
There's a webpage for your foundation?
Yes. TheAHAFoundation.org.
TheAHAFoundation.org.
Don't forget T-H-E in front of A-H-A.
TheAHAFoundation.org.
Yeah.
Now, we can't say a lot about it, but we can at least tease the audience that you have a new book coming out. And what is it called?
It's called Nomad, and will be on the markets on the 18th of May this year.
Well, you're a nomad. You're traveling all over the world.
I know. It wasn't hard to choose this title.
But you look good and happy and prosperous, and you're doing well.
America has been good to me.
Good. Everybody worries about you and how you're doing with your nomadic existence. And
yeah, I don't know. I just think America is really, really good to me, and I feel free, and I have wonderful friends. I'm really blessed.
Secularly blessed.
Secularly blessed, and I found a new tribe to replace with my old tribe.
Well, thank you.
And this one is more fun.
Thank you, Ayan Hirsi Ali. We're talking
so
with
much.
Her in person here in Madison, Wisconsin. She's the author of the book Infidel, and it was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
For all your work.
Thank you.
And we also want to thank Brian Turani, who is our engineer and producer of this show. Free Thought Radio is recorded in Madison, Wisconsin. Our announcer and the engineer for the Ayan Hirsi Ali interview is Buzz Kemper. Go to ffrf.org/radio to hear all these shows archived and for podcast.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. Support Free Thought Radio's broadcasts and podcasts by becoming a member, and support our work for separation of church and state. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.